Welcome to the Education Gadfly Show. I'm your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Today, Joshua Dunn, Executive Director of the Institute of American Civics at the University of Tennessee, joins us to discuss what the end of the Chevron Doctrine could mean for schools. Then, on the Research Minute, Amber reports on a new paper criticizing early research on class size reduction. All this on the Education Gadfly Show.
This is the Education Gadfly Show.
There are some problems with the study, people, and we probably need not put it on such a pedestal.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome our special guest for this week, Josh Dunn. Josh, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Mike.
Josh is Executive Director of the Institute of American Civics at the Howard H. Baker School for Public Policy and Public Affairs at the University of Tennessee. My goodness, we've got to like use some abbreviations or something to be able to get that all in.
Yeah, some acronyms would be helpful, right?
It's exciting. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about this, Josh. I know this is a new role for you, but first, let's bring in David Griffith, my co-host.
Hey, Mike. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, great to see you. So, Josh, I know you best because we work together at Education Next. Josh writes the Legal Beat column and has for many years, where I'm an executive editor. And you just moved from the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs, to the University of Tennessee. My understanding is that this is one of now perhaps a growing number of programs focused on civics at higher education institutions.
That's correct. There's several of them around the country now. You have Arizona, Texas, North Carolina, Florida, Mississippi has one. Ohio is I think five now are starting there. So yeah, there's a growing list of these civics institutes where people are concerned about lack of civic knowledge and kind of decaying civil discourse. And I think that's the mandate for all of us to try to make improvements on both those.
Well, that's exciting. Very good. I heard perhaps a rumor that our friend Lamar Alexander may have had a role in encouraging you to come to Tennessee.
Yes, yes. He was involved, and he did reach out, and I see him fairly regularly now here. Yeah, he's a visitor to the Baker School fairly often.
Oh, that's great. All right. Well, give him our best if you see him. We're here to talk about your latest column, which was on the Chevron deference. The Supreme Court had an oral hearing on this a little while ago. They're going to come out with a decision in June. Sounds wonky, could have a huge impact, though, actually, on the U.S. Department of Education and all the other federal agencies. So let's talk about it on Ed Reform Update. Okay, Josh, so the actual case is about fishing. The old doctrine is about Chevron, as in the oil company. What the heck does this have to do with education? Give us the brief tutorial. What is the Chevron deference?
So Chevron deference emerged in a case from 1984 where the Supreme Court said that courts should defer to the judgments of administrative agencies when they were interpreting ambiguous federal statutes. And the idea was that, well, generalist judges, they don't have the expertise to go and second guess the decisions of these expert administrators who have all sorts of background knowledge about the particular issues that they have to work out in applying and interpreting these federal statutes. And so there's been some criticism of Chevron deference for, really since the beginning, but it's been growing in recent years. And so now there are a couple of cases that came before the court where there's a good chance that the court overturns this Chevron deference. They think that it actually undermines the rule of law, leads to uncertainty with the law. And yeah, this really affects really any federal agency. It's obviously not just the ones before the court right now in this case. I think you could make an argument that the Department of Education might be the most affected if the court overturns Chevron.
Yeah, conservatives have argued for a long time that this is a way of basically empowering the administrative state, right? And that these regulatory agencies then end up making law, and that's supposed to be the job of Congress, right? Now, of course, Congress has not exactly been, showing itself to be a highly effective institution recently. And so the notion that Congress is going to have the capacity to get into the weeds on some of these issues, like it would need to, you know, in a complicated policy issue, like the environment or like education, like anything else, or be able to make quick changes if they've made a decision that's not working out. Whereas an administrative agency, at least maybe through rulemaking and the like, could be quicker to make adjustments and have the expertise to go deeper, right? So, and then there's a role of judges, like you said. So, you know, is this about giving power back to Congress saying, no, I'm sorry, Department of Education or any other department, you can't make the laws? Or is it about giving power back to the judges who get to decide what the law means?
Exactly. So that's one of the reasons why at least conservatives initially supported Chevron was because they thought it built in political accountability, because the idea was that presidents could then come in and influence agency rulemaking in these areas. And so you actually would have some control of the process. But I think over time, what we've seen is that often is as you mentioned, the agencies, or the concern has been the agencies then just kind of go off on their own and implement their own rules. And so you might not even get a whole lot of political oversight from the executive branch, precisely because these agencies are often insulated from direct control by presidents. I mean, presidents can exercise some, but you have career officials in these agencies and they can kind of outlast them and work through them. And so there's some dissatisfaction because of that. So then the question is, yes, what's going to happen here? Is this going to transfer authority to the courts, or will courts, maybe when you do have disputes over whether or not a statute is ambiguous, do they just kick it back to Congress and say, look, you aren't even entitled to regulate in this area? Congress has to be clear if it wants you to do something in this area.
Let's take an example that is fresh from the headlines, right? We're just like Law and Order here. And it's Title IX. The Department of Education just put out rulemaking, so proposed regulations around Title IX. We've seen this go back and forth under different administrations, right? And one of the big questions is, when Title IX says, I think the words are something like, you know, you shall not discriminate on the basis of sex, right? Or if you do, you can lose federal funding. Does that mean that by discriminating on the basis of sex, does that protect kids that are, LGBTQ? Or is that a different set of issues? And is that going too far? Is the Department of Education stretching the law when it's interpreting it that way or not?
Yeah, so obviously the Department of Education now and the Office for Civil Rights, they're arguing that the Supreme Court's decision in Bostock versus Clayton County gives them some authority to do this. That involved Title VII, but then there's still this issue about whether or not that applies to Title IX. Does the meaning of sex have the same meaning in those two? The court didn't officially decide that in Bostock versus Clayton County. So that's what the Department of Education is saying. Previously, though, that didn't get in the way of them. Back in the Obama administration, they kind of jumped headlong into this and said that it does, even before Bostock versus Clayton County. And they just issued a Dear Colleague letter. This time around with the Title IX regulations, they at least went through a kind of an abbreviated rulemaking process where they opened up notice and comment procedures. Were not as long as you would normally have, but I think it was a month or so, and they still got around 250,000 public comments on the issue. And I actually think that that was an indication that the Department of Education recognized that some of their past behavior might be coming under suspicion by the courts, where they just issue these Dear Colleague letters and run with it as if they'd gone through a regular rulemaking process. But so they did kind of go through this rulemaking process this time. And now they've just, as you mentioned, they've just now issued new regulations that should go into effect on August 1st.
Right, right. All right. But this is, again, if the court comes out and says, okay, we're changing the Chevron deference, we are now going to go back to a time when if it's ambiguous, the judges are going to have to decide it, or they're going to have to punt it back to Congress. This could be the kind of thing, right, on Title IX, or maybe on some of the discipline policies that we've seen, where there's a sense that the regulatory agencies are stretching the meaning of the law to fit their policy preferences, that you may have courts snapping back more aggressively than they did in the past.
I think there's no doubt about that. And I think that really, well, given the current composition of the Supreme Court, you're unlikely to see the Supreme Court say, okay, judges, go in and fill in the blanks now. Since it's not appropriate for agencies to do this, you can now substitute your own judgment about what's best. I don't think we're going to see that. I think it is going to be much more likely for the Supreme Court to say, yes, this is ambiguous, and you have to go to Congress for authorization to engage in rulemaking in this area. So I think that's what's going to happen. Then the complaint will be, well, Congress is kind of busy, or they can't get their act together. And I think for the Supreme Court, though, given the people who are on it now, they're going to say, well, that's Congress's problem. It's not our job to make up for their deficiencies as an institution.
So again, to the Title IX point, you'd say, well, so if we believe that the law should protect LGBTQ kids, for example, in schools, that is the job of Congress to pass a law that makes it clear that we're going to now, you know, change the language in Title IX.
I think so. Although, again, it depends on whether or not they're willing to apply this reasoning from the Bostock decision to Title IX. I think that's unlikely, though, because you do have this issue of athletics that's looming out there. Even though the Biden administration, they decided not to address athletics, and particularly with transgender students, because that was going to be political dynamite going into November. And so they've with this latest round of proposed regulation, they punted on it. But I think the Supreme Court is smart enough to know that if they actually did apply the reasoning of Bostock to Title IX, that immediately the Department of Education would go in and start issuing those kinds of regulations and saying that schools actually are mandated to allow students to participate in on the team that matches their gender identity.
So, David, how are you feeling about this? We're going to re-empower the first branch, right?
Yeah, I'm not wild about that. Basically, given the status of the first branch right now, maybe if we could turn the clock back a few decades, I'd feel differently. But I've never even experienced a functional legislature. I mostly have questions, to be honest. You know, I'm struggling to wrap my heads around the implications. I mean, and it all starts with this word ambiguous. In my lifetime, I've seen almost every clause of the Constitution debated, right? It strikes me that they're all kind of ambiguous. Your average law maybe is a little more clearly written, but I assume that they don't come with this label that says I am ambiguous on them, right? So doesn't it all just kind of boil down to judges' discretion
Well, some of that, but there can be, you can look at statutes and see where there's a clear authorization to engage in rulemaking in a particular area, and then perhaps others where it's not. And that's, you've seen the court do that with what they've called this major questions doctrine. They say, well, look, this statute, this is involves such an enormous area. If Congress actually intended for you to have this authority, they would have been explicit about it. So, and I'm sympathetic to the idea that, yeah, Congress hasn't been terribly functional, but perhaps part of the reason they haven't been functional is that that they've been able to pass off their responsibilities to agencies and courts. And so maybe this will be the thing that forces them to actually do their job.
Yeah. And look, we saw this week with Ukraine and the Israel aid, you know, sometimes when their back is up against the wall, they do act, perhaps much later than they should, but that is one way to look at it. Hey, that is all the time we've got on this discussion. I'm sure we could go much longer. And Josh, it's always a pleasure. I find this legal stuff fascinating, and I appreciate you making it clear for us.
Oh, thanks. I hope it clarified it some. You know, we can be certain, though, there'll be more litigation to help clarify it for us.
All right. Well, check out Josh's column on this at Education Next. We will link to it in the show notes. Again, Josh Dunn, Executive Director at the Institute for American Civics at the University of Tennessee. Thanks so much for joining us, Josh.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Just had a great conversation there about legal stuff. And I have to say, you know, in an alternative universe, a different timeline for my life, I think I would have gone to law school.
Really? Wow, I've never heard you say that.
I really find this stuff fascinating, you know, especially the constitutional law. I don't know. I
mean, armchair economist, Amber. Lawyer, armchair lawyer. You're also an armchair economist, though, Mike.
Oh, yes. I do also wish I'd been an economist. I know. Or maybe both. The problem with the law school thing is I don't think you are allowed to like go to law school and say, okay, I only want to go to law school if someday I get to either be on or argue in front of the Supreme Court.
Wow. That's a high goal.
I guess that's not how it works, right?
Don't sell yourself short, Mike.
Yeah. All right. I mean, maybe it's not too late.
We have these lawyers, by the way, that come and, you know, adjudicate these teacher cases on the state board. And one we affectionately call Perry Mason because he acts like he is in front of the Supreme Court. But, you know, it's just us. But anyway, he has those same ambitions, Mike, I do believe.
Well, what you got for us this week?
Oh, man, I'm gonna have to get technical on you, at least try not to. But, man, there was this NBER study that came out recently. Again, super technical, but it calls into question probably the, you know, one of the most well-known studies in education ever, which, what's that?
The star class size reduction study.
Star class size.
Oh, no.
It had serious methodological concerns. And again, I had read some of this, but not seen it so well articulated. Just a reminder, if you're under a rock, Tennessee Star used an experimental design to assess the impact of class size reduction interventions. This current study breaks down the problems with that original research. It's conducted by three economists at UPenn and Princeton, and they provided in this NBER paper a better way to analyze the results from Star reliably to gain new and useful information about class size interventions. So, hey, I thought that was a good way to frame it. STAR, again, conducted between 1985 and 1989, randomized grade kindergarten students at participating public schools into one of three class types: small, regular, and regular with a teacher's aid. Evaluations of STAR showed significantly higher scores for students attending the small class type, leading the states, if you recall, like Tennessee and Colorado, California, adopted these policies reducing class sizes, didn't live up to the hype. It's partly because California especially hired a lot of unqualified teachers to meet the new demands, which, you know, what else could they do? So these economists go into great detail about the issues with the original methodology. I'm going to try to simplify it, which is not easy because this thing is long. I think it boiled down to this two-stage least squares model was poorly aligned with the experimental design because it treated the class types as the same as class size. And class type and class size are not the same things because the school principals had discretion in choosing the target class sizes for each type. So there were substantial differences in compliance with different schools focusing on both heterogeneous sizes of classes, meaning that the dose of the intervention differed, and heterogeneous class size reductions. So the amount of the reduction also differed between the treatment and the control arms. So their model, here they go, identified a weighted average of school-specific effects. But those weights depended on each school's compliance with the demands of the experimental design, and they didn't follow that, which I'm going to tell you about that in a minute. So that all that was endogenous with the class size effectiveness model that they were using, because certain types of schools were more or less compliant with the experimental design, which, you know, first we're hearing about that, or at least first I'm hearing about it. So what they did instead was they dug into the details of the program design and implementation at each school, and they found that schools actually under-complied with the intended implementation of STAR by having class size reductions that were smaller. So the experimental design called for 13 to 17 student range for the treatment and 22 to 25 kids for the control. So the average reduction in class size between the control and treatment was 7 students. But again, it varied a lot across the schools. They had between 0 and 12. So, okay, that's a pretty big range and doesn't exactly meet the qualifications of the design. And then strangely enough, the schools that had the largest impact, the effects, they could be positive or negative. They showed the lowest compliance with reducing class sizes. Okay, so they didn't have the bigger reductions. All right, their analysis, whoo, I hope we can get through this. They did something called group random effects approach. So they're trying to fix all this stuff. So they're allowing, this allows them to model the class size levels for both the treatment and the control class types, because again, there was a lot of discretion. And they found that nearly all of the gains from reducing class size in the STAR study were driven by 29% of the schools in the sample. In fact, if the 29% of those highly sensitive schools had been omitted from the experiment, their model would have failed to detect any causal effect of class size on test scores. So then they dig into this set of schools. There are 23. So these 23 schools, which they call group two, their mean test score increase for those kids caused by reducing class size by one student equated to an improvement of 0.09 standard deviation. But when you average all across the groups and students, that same figure is 0.02 standard deviation. So it gets, you know, it's a lot higher when you're in this higher impact group. A little more about group two. They had larger undercompliance, which means they didn't, in my mind, they didn't reduce class sizes as much as intended. So they had bigger classes in general. And the students in group two also attended school between 4 and 5 days fewer. School, I mean, they had a, you know, not a, as long as a school year compared to the other two groups. And then they close, they've got this long discussion on, you know, we really need to think about how we scale these interventions that, you know, and we really need to look into the effects by subgroups of schools and think about targeting our resources and policies where they're most likely to have the largest effects, because, you know, monitoring implementation is a hard thing to do across so many schools and so on and so forth. So another scaling problem, but also some you know, important information, I think, on this study.
Wow. I mean, isn't it the case that there were other studies that used the same data, you know, to answer other questions, not just class size? I feel like maybe about teacher effectiveness or other things. And makes me just wonder about how many other findings now do we need to question whether they might not be, in fact, true?
Yeah. And I'm sure they probably got into that in this very long background section.
Well, and look, and this is not about ancient history here. I mean, we know New York City is going through this right now, you know, because unfortunately, they were able to get this class size policy through recently that's going to force them to go through and lower class sizes in every school, including in the affluent schools. And, you know, a lot of us are worried that we're going to see again that's going to lead teachers to transfer from the high poverty schools to the more affluent ones. The high poverty schools are going to have lower quality teachers, and then we're not going to get the results that we want. So, but it, you know, so I thought you were going to just tell us that they were able to tease out sort of what happens when you scale up. And of course there's variation, but it seems like it's even more fundamental than that, that the actual study had some serious problems, and that we need to be much more realistic about what class size reduction can achieve. Based on it, even if scaled up effectively, even without all of the problems with, say, lower quality teachers.
And other folks have pointed out it was just 1 in 5 schools that agreed to participate. And so you would think if you agreed to participate, then you would play by the rules. But there was just a lot of, you know, flexibility in how these interventions were carried out.
Yeah, it's troubling. I mean, it's not that troubling if you're skeptical of class size reductions, right? But it is troubling. I guess the fundamental problem, as I understood it, was that the schools that implemented it most diligently saw essentially no effect, right? And the schools that implemented it sort of half-heartedly saw bigger effects, and that was sort of inexplicable to the researchers.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I if they had larger under compliance, I'd think that through, right? That means they had the bigger class sizes. So, and they had the bigger impact. I mean, right? Am I thinking about that right, David?
Well, or the difference, again, the difference, they may be all, it could have been that they had small class sizes throughout, right? Or big class sizes throughout. It was just that the differences weren't that large.
Yeah, as I understood what you were saying, it was that the differences were between the two were smaller in the places where there were bigger effects. Was that what you were saying?
The differences between the, right, the group two had the larger, had the bigger class sizes because they undercomplied more. And the other schools that I guess didn't have as high a level of undercompliance didn't have the effects.
Okay.
It can kind of make your head hurt when you think about it, but I think I'm thinking about it right.
Okay. It's the kind of logic puzzle you might find on the LSAT. So again, back to law school idea.
Yes. There are some problems with the study, people, and we probably need to not put it on such a pedestal. I think that's my my takeaway, and that, you know, hey, it gets down to a very plain fact about how hard it is to scale anything, even if it was a good intervention.
Yep. No, I think that's right. I think that as research has improved, it does mean that it's a higher bar for some of those old studies back in the day. All right. Well, we will need to let that be that because that is all the time we've got for this week. So until next week.
I'm Amber Northern.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.